Hey, it's me, Jeff. As you're well aware, each week we produce a podcast that is a conversation with a lawmaker, political scientist, journalist, those types of people. Also each week, on Fridays, we have this weekly roundup of North Carolina political news. And what we're going to try to do a much better job of in the coming weeks is separating those two, so that earlier in the week, you get a longer conversation, and then on Fridays, it's Becky and Rob. So, here's our Friday weekly roundup with Becky Gray of the Conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from NC Policy Watch.
Hello.
Afternoon, guys.
On Tuesday, in a landmark court ruling, judges struck down state legislative maps for being illegally partisan. The panel of three state judges unanimously declared that 77 of the General Assembly's 170 districts violate the North Carolina Constitution. Judges gave legislators 2 weeks to enact new maps. Lawmakers were told to use greater transparency during this upcoming process and not to use partisan data. Those new political boundaries will then receive review from the bench and from a yet-to-be-appointed map referee. Republicans have signaled that they will not appeal to the Democratic-dominated state Supreme Court. This is a major decision. Interested to hear both of your thoughts, of course. First, Becky, do you believe this will result in fair or fairer maps?
Well, I really don't. And the reason why I say that is the instruction from the judges were that the maps were too partisan. Extreme partisan is, I think, the terms that they used. However, they didn't really define that, so we still don't know what that means. And I think that opens that door or leaves that loophole. Now, what I hope will happen is that, and we've talked about this before on the show, and this is something Rob and I agree on, is that some sort of alternative method to redistricting comes out of this with stricter, more clearly defined rules.
Unlikely that that's going to happen in the next 2 weeks, though.
Probably, yes. Yes. And will we have different maps under this? Yes. And the criteria that the judges have put forward should give them some guidance in how to do these less extreme partisan gerrymandered districts, but we still don't really know what that means.
I think the judges went to great lengths to try and make clear to the legislature what they need to do. They had a long list of specific directives. It's a 350-page opinion. They obviously took this very seriously and were trying to set out some specific criteria. I'm certain we will have fairer, better maps. I do have concerns that, I mean, the people still in charge remain the Republican lawmakers who have designed the partisan gerrymandered maps already. I'm sure they still have some tricks to play up their sleeve. I'm sure they'll do everything they can to try and draw maps that they think are still as favorable as possible to the Republican majority. So I think people should watch very carefully. I think Common Cause did a good job when they came forward and listed a bunch of specific things that they hope will happen. They called on lawmakers not only to have live video feeds so we can watch it all, but to actually have public hearings before and after. That would be a good step to take, to actually let the public have a say on this. So it's not perfect, and it's not a permanent fix. It's only for the next election, right? We're not going to have we need a permanent fix, and I think we should have some sort of independent redistricting commission that can do this in public and have a public process going forward.
I think there's loads of uncertainty moving forward, how this process plays out, what it looks like. So yeah, there are a lot of questions that we'll get answers to in the weeks to come. We certainly will talk about this again later in September and perhaps in October. A speculative question, but indulge me. Ultimately, do you think it's going to be lawmakers or judges who pass these maps? To be clear, lawmakers have a chance here. But as the ruling, as I read it, mm-hmm. parts of it, read, they better not screw up. They better not do too much in secrecy here, or these judges are going to snatch this map-making power away. So again, a speculative question, but who do you think ultimately will establish the next set of maps?
I think the lawmakers will.
You think they'll abide by the guidelines?
I absolutely do, yes. As Rob mentioned, that he felt like the judges took this and this decision seriously in this very lengthy judgment that they issued. I think the lawmakers are taking this very seriously as well, and I think they're going to do it and do the best they can with these criteria that have been laid out and with this very short 2-week time period.
I'm hopeful that that's the case. I am certain that if there's any inkling that they haven't, that the plaintiffs will be right back to the judges, and these judges will be watching it very, very closely.
One more quick follow-up on this. I recorded the WNC Politics podcast. Gary Robertson and Lauren Horsch were in here. We were talking about just some of the things that we are wondering about and keeping an eye on moving forward. Among those things, whether or not this is going to spark a challenge to the congressional maps in North Carolina along partisan lines, whether or not this makes things more competitive or very competitive next year. I mean, those are just a couple of examples. As we dissect, we're going to move on here in a second, but what else are you your main takeaways, or what else were you left wondering about or grasping at or noting after this big ruling on Tuesday?
Well, to me, there still remains this big question. Are we going to get a permanent fix? Are we going to enact some sort of genuine redistricting reform that will be lasting, not this cockamamie scheme that's been proposed where we're going to turn it over to the legislative staff to draft the maps, but a true open process of the kind that the judges have prescribed here? To me, that's the overriding question. I think going forward, the Democrats are always already very hopeful for 2020. They think it's going to be a big year, and one would presume that fairer maps would help them out in the 2020 election.
The thing that struck me out of the whole 345-page judgment was the criteria that these three judges sort of validated, if you will. We first saw these in the Stevenson case, a redistricting case several years ago. And I'll go back to, if this is going to work and if there is going to be a permanent fix, it has to be around the rules that are in place from which those districts are drawn. And the judges included acceptable criteria in this judgment that include equal population, congruity of the districts, compactness of the district, not going across county lines except when they had to, keeping those things compact. And this is all with previous court standards for the county groupings was another piece that they had in there. My biggest hope for a permanent fix and where we go from here is not only in the next 2 weeks do we see districts drawn according to these standards and these criteria that have been pretty widely accepted, but where we go from there. And there are several redistricting bills under consideration that certainly could be taken up before they adjourn, one of which sets that criteria in our state constitution. That's really where my greatest hope for real reform and more towards a permanent fix with this comes.
Speaking of elections, there are two special congressional elections taking place right now. Early voting polls are still open in some areas across the state. Election day is Tuesday for the 3rd and 9th congressional districts. One seat was left vacant when U.S. House Representative Walter Jones died back in February. The other district, listeners may remember, has been empty since election officials refused to certify the results of a contest that was stained with absentee ballot election fraud. What are you watching in these final few days of the race, Rob?
I think the whole country is watching the 9th district. The 9th district is the district that's attracting millions of dollars of outside money. It's in the national spotlight, and it's, by all indications, nip and tuck.
Republican Dan Bishop has also requested
at least a moderate, partial extension. I think Democrats may have asked for more of an extension in early voting.
Of course, when we're talking about, you know, the voting timelines and when this is and all, one of the things that is always a disadvantage in these special elections is it's off our regular beaten path of when we think about going to vote. Very low turnout traditionally for these special elections. And this is the only thing on the ballot in both the 3rd and the 9th. So the whole question, I think, is who turns out, when do they turn out? But at the end of the day, by the time the polls close on Tuesday, who has come out during this off-season special election and then also in the aftermath of the storm and what particularly folks in the 3rd district may be dealing with after that. So I think it's all about the turnout.
It will be seen as a referendum on Trump, one way or the other. Though both sides, the winner is going to claim it's a referendum pro-Trump or against Trump, depending, you know, if the Republicans win, it's pro-Trump. If Democrats win, they'll say it's a referendum that Trump is, you know, against him.
The other thing about this to keep in mind is, you know, we will be past this by the time we get together next week. This will be over. But
the election and
the election.
Storm,
yeah. Well, right. Yeah, exactly. But don't forget that whoever is seated in these congressional seats, it is only until the next election. The filing for that election is in December. So this is something we're going to be talking about again in the not too very distant future.
Correct. And going back to our first story, it is possible that the district, the actual physical district which these two winners are elected to serve, that the district lines could change if there's a legal challenge. I mean, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here, but it's chaos per usual. quick follow-up on the referendum notion of the NC 3rd and the 9th. Do you think that that stuff gets a little overstated in the 24/7 cable news cycle? I mean, do you?
Yeah, there aren't many elections to focus on, right? So the ninth, but the ninth is a striking district because it is a solidly Republican mm-hmm. district that, were it apparently not for election fraud, would have gone for a Democrat in 2018, or at least certainly very, very close. And if the Democrats can pick up that seat, obviously it's noteworthy.
Well, and both of the Republican candidates in these two elections have attached themselves to Trump, have had Trump come
That's
in
right.
to campaign for them. Members of the Trump team, Vice President Mike Pence, you know, have been in. So they certainly have used the association with President Trump, whether it's to their advantage or not, I guess we'll see.
President and Vice President are scheduled to visit and stump to support Republican Dan Bishop in the ninth in the coming days. Hurricane Dorian has struck, and for the third time in 4 years, North Carolina residents are dealing with the effects of a major storm. Tornadoes, storm surge, powerful winds, heavy rains, flooding. As the storm departs, cleanup and residual problems commence. An article published in the Washington Post this week addressed what have become routine efforts to rebuild and repair, then prepare for the next storm. The state is trying to implement a buyback program to compensate homeowners in areas that have been repeatedly struck and get those folks to higher, safer places to live. The article notes, a 2017 National Institute of Building Sciences report found that every $1 spent on mitigation efforts can save the nation $6 in disaster spending. Big picture, looking ahead, in the weeks and months to come, what should state government do as we think about the next storm, whether that's a month from now or 3 years from now? Becky?
Well, I think we really need to evaluate, first of all, the damage that has occurred to help people get back on their feet, to get businesses back on their feet. But, you know, a lot of this damage that's being done that we've seen in the previous storms are things that we were going to have to deal with anyway. Some of the water and sewer damages, some of the damages to the roads in very vulnerable areas, some of the water and sewer systems that we have, particularly in the eastern part of the state, are 50 years or older, built with materials and methods that were designed to last no more than 50 years. So we really got to look at some of those things. I think that is the role of government, and that is to build infrastructure. But as far as like rebuilding people's homes, I think there also really has to be an evaluation of where should we rebuild? Where does it not make sense? Where perhaps do we need to not encourage rebuilding of things? And it's everything from looking at insurance rates, looking at you know, what is the responsibility? Make sure that public policy doesn't encourage people to rebuild in areas that are always going to be a problem and continually in need of that rebuilding.
So to hammer you down on that a little bit, should public policy then discourage people or ban people from living in certain areas? Should certain areas no longer be zoned for residential?
I think that's something that we certainly have to look at. And for, you know, people, for individuals to assume responsibility when they choose to live in very high-risk areas.
Yeah, this is the new normal. Tragically, we have a situation in which North Carolina is on the front line of an international, a global crisis, the global climate crisis, and the hurricanes that are now happening every year are clearly a function of that, and we have been burying our heads in the sand for the last several years. We have been acting in North Carolina like it's 1979 or 1969. The Republican legislative leaders have, you know, don't want to talk about sea level rise, haven't wanted to talk about climate change or carbon pollution. Governor Cooper, to his great credit, has tried to lift those issues back up, but we're not doing nearly enough. It truly is a crisis. Our lives are never going to quite be the same in this state or around the planet. We got to get really serious about it right away, and this is just another warning sign of that fact.
But I don't disagree with Rob, but I think we also need to make sure that we don't overreact and become too prohibitive or implement things that are costly without really evaluating the benefit.
Has that happened here?
No, not yet, but I think that we need to move forward cautiously.
Let me give you an example. Lisa Sorg, our environmental reporter, wrote some stories this week. She pointed out that, for instance, we have 500 million chickens in eastern North Carolina on poultry farms that are essentially unregulated. We've got millions of hogs, not to mention 150,000 farm workers mostly living in trailers and transient housing.
In low-lying areas.
We've basically treated Eastern North Carolina as a giant sewer. I mean, that's what we're doing. That's what we continue to do. It's going to continue to look like that unless we get very, very serious about changing development in the eastern part of the state, investing in infrastructure at a much higher rate. This is going to cost money. It's going to take tax dollars to do it. But as the report says, a dollar spent now is worth six later, and we've got to get serious about it right away.
Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks. Stay safe.
Thank you.